catch Talking Heads frontman David Byrne live at Boston's Museum of Science on May 8th. David will be appearing to talk about what for centuries scientists and philosophers have called the eel question. Much of these mysterious creatures' life cycle remains a mystery even in our advanced scientific age. David will be joined by perhaps our greatest cultural authority on the eel question, Patrick Svensson, author of the acclaimed Book of Eels. Limited tickets remain, so please get yours at singforscience.org/events. Sing for Science is made possible in part by a grant from the Simons Foundation. Today's episode was recorded live on February 29th in Brooklyn, New York at On Air Fest. Please be sure to check out our other episodes, including our Webby Award-honored On Air Fest appearance from 2022 with Kilo Kish and Dr. Wendy Suzuki on the topic of brain plasticity. And if you like our show, may we humbly ask that you take a couple minutes to give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. Thanks for listening.
Blue is not generally the colors of objects. If you do a big survey, we did this with these, you know, these databases of images that people are spitting out for machine learning algorithms to do automatic image recognition. They get tens of thousands of these images and someone somewhere has tagged whether or not there's an object in it. And we went through and we just looked at the colors of all these things that people say are objects. And blue is grossly underrepresented.
Blue spaces. Blue spaces.
Welcome to Sing for Science, the show where musicians and scientists talk about music and science. I'm your host, Matt White. Each week, we'll talk about a song by our guest artist and how it connects with our guest scientist's area of expertise. Today, we'll be speaking with Indian Carnatic singer and R&B songwriter, Sid Sriram. Sid has had a hugely successful career as a playback singer for Bollywood cinema, and just last year released his debut album of Western music on Def Jam Records. The album highlights Sid's vocal prowess and ability to deftly navigate his unique blend of Indian and American styles. One of the album's standout tracks is the meditative Blue Spaces, on which Sid weaves in lyrics related to homecoming and cultural appropriation. Also joining us is neuroscientist, artist, and color expert, Dr. Bevel Conway. Bevel is currently a lead investigator for the National Institute of Health, where his lab seeks to understand how sensory information, like sights and sounds, are transformed into perceptual experiences by our brains. Within this framework, Bevel has been able to explore the illusory and subjective nature of color perception in our brains. And as a result, Bevel was the expert voice called on to make sense of the viral internet image in 2015 of a dress that appeared blue and black to some and white and gold to others. The title of this week's episode on the podcast is Blue Spaces, Understanding the Ranges of Color Perception in the Human Brain. Please help me welcome to the stage Sid and Bevel. So Sid, I noticed that you started the Tiny Desk performance with something different from the recorded version,
sure.
Something more akin to what I would consider Indian classical music. So is that typical of the style that you sing as a playback singer?
Actually, no. So that is a Hindu prayer to the god Ganesha. And my Carnatic concerts, so my classical concerts, I always start with that exact prayer, just melodically a little bit different depending on the composition that's going to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And the Tiny Desk felt like the first time I was really getting to show the Western world the entire makeup of who I am.
Mm.
And it felt most appropriate to really usher in that performance with that prayer. The prayer specifically is a call to remove obstacles.
Mm.
We were all quite nervous that day when we entered the building to do the Tiny Desk. So I think it was just like it washed through the room, it cleansed us, and then we went about the set.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
Speaking to the song itself, there's nothing in the lyrics that to me suggests there's an obvious connection between the lyrics and the title, Blue Spaces. So I'm curious to hear what the song's about.
Sure. I think this song, the whole album, but this song especially, it felt like there was a wave of inspiration that kind of hit us. And I didn't spend a moment really intellectualizing any of the lyrics. It just kind of came and really was a practice of channeling. But as I made sense of it after the song was complete, it really feels like one assertion of identity, of this is who I am, a stake in the ground, and also an examining of just voids within, what those feel like, how one can attempt to fill those voids. It's really just asking the questions and kind of exploring what those massive spaces of emptiness and then sudden filling of that vacuum, you know, what that feels like, what that sensation is. And even today, just as I gotta look out, you know, you see the sky and then you see the river over there, and I associate blue with the sense of vastness. And that's the emotion that I wanted to bring to the song. Obviously, from there, from that abstract kind of feeling, it moves into more specific ideas of, I think you mentioned, like cultural appropriation. I think another aspect or anchor point of the song for me was looking at how I myself, being first generation from India to the US, how I've kind of tokenized my culture in certain points when I was younger, and undoing that. Hmm. And in the undoing of that, you know, unmasking some deep pain, the song is an exercise in trying to find my way to solace through unmasking these different kind of scars or spaces of emptiness.
And so it's blue that describes that void.
Yeah, and I think blue, to me, I've associated, or maybe it's been pretty traditionally associated with like pain or a sense of grief. But I think there's also, again, I think vastness is the word that always comes to mind. It just feels like an infinite kind of feeling when I think of blue, the spectrum of the color. Mm. And this song felt like me really entering just like an infinite space of exploration of self.
Yeah.
And that's the, so the hook is blue spaces coming down on me. So it's just like, yeah, those, that kind of thing that feels like it's outside of me, that's infinite. What happens when it enters within oneself and what that feels like? Because it's pretty overwhelming, you know, when there's a vastness that enters the internal and grappling with that.
And I think when you first came on my radar and I heard this track, even before this idea occurred to me for this conversation between you two, the thing that I thought of, especially looking at your album cover, which is just so rich in color, and I think about Indian culture, which to me, and I've never been there, but Indian culture, it just has such, by comparison, such a vibrant representation of color.
Sure.
I just think of it in the textiles, in the food, everything. And I know you go back and forth between India and the States.
Yeah.
I'm curious, is that your experience? You get off the plane and like you're assaulted with color? Or is that just kind of my assumption being a Westerner?
Oh, no, there's definitely a truth to that. I think keeping in mind that India is like a very large country with each region being, you know, quite distinct from the other. Mm. But one uniform kind of characteristic that I have found traveling through the country, I'm from Chennai, which is in southern India. And definitely when I land in my city, it's not only color, but it's just a lot of information thrown at you all at once, while still feeling extremely grounded. You know, I feel like there's a vibrancy that pulses through the whole country, in my experience, definitely in the region that I frequently visit and live in, is a vibrancy. There's a lot of information, a lot of chaos, but there's a grace in it. There's a certain order to it that I think has definitely subconsciously informed the way I view music. I listen to music and I experience sound. One specific thing I think that really stands out to me is Southern Indian temple architecture. And it's very colorful, but also there's this idea of the architecture is almost made up of these like small building blocks that all come together to build a whole. And I think that has also really informed the way I think about music, is vibrant, colorful modules that can be kind of digested, thought about, and then put to work in different ways. It's kind of how I've viewed music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does the color blue represent anything specific in India? And I guess another one of my assumptions before today was just because the song kind of had a melancholy tone that there was some corresponding characteristic about feeling blue. And now that you've described it, I realize that's not what it is. And interestingly enough, our host just mentioned this episode I did a couple weeks ago with a Jungian analyst, and she admitted to butchering this, but we were talking about the universality of human experience across the globe.
Sure.
And she was saying how she had read that, I guess, either a scale or a raga in Indian music that connotes a feeling of sadness and mournfulness is most similar to our minor scale in Western music, which of course sounds intuitive, but is staggering when you think about it, that these places on opposite sides of the world,
sure,
for some reason, the minor third in the scale,
yeah,
you know, that means sad.
Yep.
So is there something in blue like that's equivalent?
I'm honestly not sure. I don't know that there is necessarily like a specific correlation, like color to something that is an underpinning of the culture. Mm. The first thing that comes to mind is if you look at like Hindu deities,
mm-hmm,
you look at Rama or Krishna, they're traditionally a certain shade. You look at Shiva, like a deep blue. But I'm not sure if there's like a specific correlation color to something that I have necessarily drawn from. For me, it was definitely just coming from a space of like abstraction,
right,
and subconscious. I think also me not knowing that speaks just to the fact that my internalization of my culture is just definitely something that has been passed on a very subconscious,
sure,
level. I haven't necessarily done a lot of the work to logically kind of break down these things or dig in deeper. And I kind of like it that way. I think with a song like this one, it is very much like there's a specific raga that I weave in and out of the song.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one that feels very melancholic. And I think it was just like putting these feelings, specific melodic source points or influences, and the color, like putting them all next to each other and just leaving them there and like letting listeners kind of draw the connections as they wish or examine it or just look at it and see what it inspires.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think as Bevel can attest, our perception of color and its cultural representations is a big piece of the puzzle. But also what it means to different people is extremely subjective. So, Bevel, I'll let you riff if you would.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's fascinating listening to you talk. I think there are so many points of contact here that would be fun to explore and unravel. But I think one of the most fascinating aspects of color for me is how it functions as a kind of language. And like a language, it when you speak the language, you know, you think everybody understands what you're saying. It's like, you know, when I was living in Nepal and I met someone who didn't speak English, I'd speak louder as if somehow that would make it clearer. It's like unfathomable to me that you don't understand what I'm saying. And it's the same with the kinds of associations that people make with colors, is that they take on this language-like connection that feels very potent, and it is, it's serving that role. But actually that belies the abstract and powerful nature of color, which is that it can actually take on lots of different meanings. Mm. So when you talk about it being vast and, you know, Matt talks about it being lonely and sad, it's like, yes, it can be both of these things. And that's actually what makes color an incredibly powerful tool that's exploited in almost every culture.
Sure.
Blue itself is our oldest pigment. You know, there's evidence going back almost 10,000 years to woad as a, you know, that's the mustard seed. They have evidence that this was, wow, this was being grown probably for the purpose of making that bluish pigment. I mean, there's this countercurrent that every time I talk about color, someone raises the Radiolab podcast and says, oh, there was this great Radiolab. Yeah, and a lot of what they talk about is predicated on a lie. It was a fabrication in a BBC documentary where this young scientist who does not study color was instructed by the BBC people to tell the participants to pretend they couldn't see blue from the greens in the little display because their language apparently doesn't have a word for blue. And this is like run like wildfire, that there are some languages that just don't have a word for blue and they don't see blue. And it's total bullshit. History is fascinating. It started with one of the prime ministers of England in the 1800s, who argued that the ancient Greeks didn't have a word for blue. And the reason that he made that claim is that there was not a direct mapping from what he conceived of as blue to what how they were using their color terms. So he assumed, well, and this is the language piece, he assumed, well, they just can't see it. It's like classic kind of colonial projection. Well, you're just incapable. You're like inferior. Mm. You must be colorblind. Mm. Whereas it turns out that modern scholars have looked through the ancient Greek texts. They have probably 3-4 words for blue, and they're all different facets. So there's the kind of shiny blue of the sky when it's kind of shimmery, but it's not decoupled from brightness. There's a kind of blue of the depth of the ocean that has a, you know, a changeable quality. They had lots of words. It's just, and from their point of view, looking back to us, you know, they probably think we're colorblind because you call all of that blue. It's like, hang on a minute. There's like lots of different blues going. So blue is a particularly interesting color from that point of view because it's really got a quite a complex history. And it's strangely enough, you know, in survey after survey for a very long time, blue is the most commonly preferred color. So you look around the room, people are wearing blue jeans. I look around the room, I'm thinking to myself, we're talking about color and what are you all in your spring colors of grays and browns? It's like, welcome to New York. We have less and less color as the days go by. Hmm. But it is fascinating that blue is the go-to color as a color preference. I saw someone had some blue glasses back there and I was like, oh yeah, that's... And part of the reason is that blue is not generally the colors of objects. And so is it a chicken and egg? Is it that we only look at the blue things in the world and ignore them, don't call them objects? Or is it genetic? These are some of the questions that we're trying to investigate. But it does set blue up as this kind of interesting void, sure, in a sense. Like it's the colorless color, the thing that is at peace, we're at peace. And at the same time, this thing that, you know, is almost like a balm, like we kind of want to have it take away some of the pain or something.
So much of what you just talked about, well, one thing which I knew nothing about is the fact that, I think you said that it's like the oldest pigment. And it's interesting to me. I create music from a very subconscious space, and what's always been very exciting is to bring definition to songs after they've been written. And a key line in this song, Blue Spaces, is why are you trying to rob the culture? Robbing me is robbing culture. And so much of what you just talked about, especially like the colonialism and the fact that the perception around this shade or this color has been so almost like constrained in a way. Yeah. And that ties right into something I'm talking about in the song. And it kind of leads me to the fact that I think... something as infinite as, again, I just go back to the fact that, you know, you say blue is not really seen in objects, but it's like surrounding us at all times.
But we don't touch it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, this is the poetry of touching the sky.
Sure.
It's like, well, that is the thing that you can't touch.
Right. Yeah. It's just, it's always magical to see resonance points in spaces where you didn't really have knowledge of something before, but it's still very kind of synergistically. Like,
and hearing you sort of quote back to me, blue being the oldest pigment, I can hear people saying, but Lascaux caves, tens of thousands of years, the oldest pigments are the ochres, the earth tones, the charcoal and so on. Blue is sort of the oldest pigment where it looks like someone really went out of their way to like grow the thing and extract the thing and preserve the thing. And its colonial history is, I don't know how many of you know this, but it's deeply intertwined with American history. You know, the whole indigo trade. Mm-hmm. Indigo is a pigment made from a plant that's a nasty plant to grow. And that trade for indigo pigment fueled the slave trade, a lot of the slave trade. There are actually ledgers that weigh up human lives against amounts of indigo pigment. Mike, when I got into this business, you know, doing visual neuroscience, studying color, my colleagues were like, why? Color's irrelevant. You know, it's like, you can tell someone's face from a black and white picture. You can, movie, you know, I mean, color, what's, that's not vision. Vision is like object recognition. Is it this thing or that thing? I was like, but there's this other, I don't know, it's ineffable. There's this other thing that color does for us. It seems like it's got some kind of intimate connection to identity and who we are. And a friend of mine who's a scholar of this history was like, well, you know that if anyone quibbles with you at color being important, it's like the value of human life is weighed in color. And of course, you know, people buy jewels and gold rings. And I mean, this is all just because it's color. It's like, I heard one person say that what's driven industrial development in sort of America and in the West has been sort of pornography and color. So we have HD TVs and so on. Anyway, so
you said the word ineffable just now, and I've heard you say something that really struck me, and that's that color is a stand-in metaphor to something that's truly ineffable. You know, and you've really gone under the hood to see why that is. And I think that's one of the more fascinating things that comes up in your research, and I'll show some pictures here. I had to ask Bevel's permission if we could talk about the dress. I'm sure he got sick of talking about it at some point.
No, it's like my 15 minutes of fame.
this is I've got the Rubik's Cubes up next to one another on the screen. I don't know if you can see that, Bevel.
I can't. I can see the back of it. Okay. But I can describe it because I know it vividly. So this is actually a very old illusion. It's an image made by Bo Lotto of a very old phenomenon called color constancy. And for those of you that came here for some science, I'll give you 1 second of science. Okay. The light that hits your eyes, you can imagine it as the amount of wavelengths. So long wavelengths to short wavelengths, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, the rainbow. You have different proportions of different wavelengths, right? That's what hits your eyes. But that, the quantity of each of those wavelengths, is determined by two variables. The spectral content, the wavelengths in the light source, and the absorptive property of the pigment of the surface, right? So those of you mathematicians, we get one known, the thing entering your eye, and there are two unknowns, and those two unknowns can vary. So how the hell can we ever see color is a great mystery. And the only way you can do it is by making an assumption about what you think the quality of the light is. And we do this automatically. So you go around and you're like, oh, it's a blue sky. I think I'm going to subtract some of the blue from what I'm looking at. And now I'm going to interpret that thing, you know, as, you know, less blue because I'm color correcting given what I think the illuminant is. So this illusion here is a simulation of what you do automatically without even thinking about it, where one cube is simulate under a simulated bluish light and the other is a simulated warmish light. And the two checks, one that looks blue under the yellow light and one that looks yellow under the blue light, are actually physically identical when they're surrounded by white.
And so they're both gray.
Yeah.
So does that mean that like the corresponding wavelengths for each color are almost arbitrary? I mean, they must mean something, right?
Yeah, there is no, the other bit of science you'll get here today is that there is no wavelength color correlation. Okay, it's not like long wavelengths mean this and short wavelengths mean that. I can take any wavelength, any combination of wavelengths, and have them appear any color by screwing with the context, your expectations, your priors. It's quite a fascinating, fabulous, complicated thing that serves up for you the impression that, oh, it's easy, everybody speaks English. You know, it's like that kind of quality. And that's what makes it actually a really powerful tool for me as a neuroscientist trying to understand how the mind and brain work, because it's got all of the hallmarks of all of the stuff that we do. So when I say, you know, what's the color of a banana? You say yellow. You're not even looking at a banana. You've just had a thought, right? Mm. So where did that thought come from? And how is it built up? And how can you trace it back to your experience? And these are all the sorts of things that, you know, define who we are and, you know, the hallmarks of intelligence and so on.
So I have a question. So does that mean that the way I perceive a certain color and the way you do and register is going to be different, even like maybe in a nuanced way?
So, yeah, I mean, there are lots of different ways to answer that question. And one of the things that makes humans, and this is true for all humans, special as a species is we have a very sophisticated, elaborate language. And our language serves this purpose, like, and I mean like the stuff we're doing right now, sure. talking. It serves this purpose, which allows us to have consensus ideas. So instead of, in a conventional kind of evolutionary sense, you know, if I want a new species, if I want a species to adapt, and you're talking to an evolutionary biologist, they'll say, oh, you know, they mutate, make a bunch of babies that are all a little different genetically, and then the ones that do well in that cold water, they survive and may make more babies that do well in cold water, you know, that sort of thing. So that adaptation happens across generations through gradual changes in mutation. We do something completely different. We inherited that ability through conventional genetic adaptation, but our ability to adapt is entirely based on culture and, or not entirely, but sure. largely based on culture and language. So, you know, if it's hot outside, I can say, it's hot outside, you might want to wear a coat. You know, you don't have to mutate and make a new baby that, you know, you can go and do that thing. So this is a very long way of saying language is really instrumental for determining our experience of the world. Sure. So, and it does it in this amazing way where, like, if you think we all have different fingerprints, right? We all have different fingerprints, and yet, you know, we define this shape the same. It's like a circle is a circle. And you don't go around asking the question, is your sense of circle the same as my sense of circle, right? But it clearly must be slightly different because you have different fingerprints than I do. So there are two pieces of this. One is the power of language to overwrite or to allow us to interpret the sense data that comes to us. And also, why does color get singled out as this thing that we appeal to for this question? And you're not the first to ask the question. I mean, I'm sure you know that. But it's because color is so, like, it's part of who we are. Sure. It's like how we define ourselves. It's very much part of our identity.
Mm-hmm. I ask because I look at art or music or visual art, whatever it may be, as a very interesting context where you can examine or find resonance points and overlaps, but also the way I react emotionally to a certain sound, again, because of language and cultural context, there's going to be similarities in the way something makes one person feel versus another.
Absolutely.
But there's also very kind of fundamental differences at the same time. And I just find it, I think it's fascinating to think about taking that forward, how a certain color might make someone feel, you know.
And that's powerful for us culturally because we actually benefit. I mean, it sounds trite and cliche, but we benefit by the diversity of experiences that we have. A colleague of mine did a very nice study looking at assessments of beauty. And showed that you can take identical twins who have exactly the same genes and they've been raised in the same household, so they have almost the same environment. And they will make different choices, they have different preferences. About 50% of, you know, the variance, if you know, the extent to which you think something is beautiful is completely private. And it's reliable and consistent. It's not some arbitrary thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that will turn out to be the case if it isn't already proven in color. As far as the fingerprint analogy, in humans, we have three cone types in the eye. And they're not red, green, and blue. That's what they're called. Red, green, and blue are the outputs of the eye and the brain and the whole thing through language. The three cone types, their peak tunings are to, like, you know, bluish and greenish and yellowish green. I mean, they're not even... they don't even line up with red, green, and blue. But there are, in terms of the genes that make those things happen, there are something like 23 different versions of the L and the M, the long and the middle wavelength sensitive cones. So the chances that you and I have exactly the same retinas and retinal sensitivity to light is very slim. Mm. And yet we get by because we have language that sort of takes that variability and pulls out the thing that's actually communicable, that's worth communicating.
Is there a genetic component to, because you did publish a paper about the dress, right?
We've published several, but yes, I'm embarrassed to say.
Well, so is there
a genetic... It turned out to be a real piece of science. I mean, I didn't think it would be.
Is there, now I've got the dress up, is there a genetic component to that explanation? Who sees it one way and who sees it the other?
We haven't done that, but people have claimed. We did, the argument we had, so the dress, for those of you that have lived under a rock and don't know about this thing, it's this crappy photograph. I shouldn't say that. It's a poorly made photograph, blurry photograph that doesn't have enough information in it to tell you about the lighting. So when you walk in this room right now, you unconsciously have all of these cues to how much light there is. You can look at it, you can see outside, there's lots of information that you're unconsciously mopping up. In this tiny little close crop photograph, it's like you don't even know that you don't have enough information to know. And it turns out some people pick up a cue in it that says that it's warm colored light, as in direct sunlight or one of those big spotlights. And other people think it's in shadow. And if you think it's in shadow, then you're going to subtract out the blue component because it's sort of under a blue sky, under a shadowed sky, and you'll more likely see it as white and cold. And if you, you know, think it's in direct warm-colored light, you subtract out the orange component, you see it as blue and black. And that was the hypothesis that, you know, gave me my minute of fame and has turned out to be true. Whether or not those priors, the sort of assumptions you make about the lighting, are because, you know, you happen to be a morning person that spends a lot of time in daylight, you know, or whether, you know, there's some genetic component, that is still very much being fought about. But and more I've people. Exited that okay. particular debate.
Well, let's ask you one last question on the dress before you close the book. Is that... more people saw it as blue and black than white and gold?
No, initially it was about 50-50. Okay. And now, this is another fascinating thing about language, almost everybody knows that the dress, the real physical object, is unequivocally blue and black. And so now, overwhelmingly, people will interpret it as blue and black, which is evidence to the point that knowledge changes you experience.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've got a couple minutes. Does anyone have any questions? There's no other mic, is there? Okay. Okay, go for it.
Question for Bethel. For people who are born blind, how do they perceive color?
They don't. So they get information about color through language, and they will develop rich conceptual causal knowledge of color. So if you ask a blind person, you know, what does red mean? They'll be able to give you an intelligible answer. But it's very, the evidence is pretty compelling that they don't have a perceptual experience of redness. Mm-hmm.
Does that change the way that they perceive the world at all?
I'm sure it does. Yeah.
But there's no way we could truly know what it's like to be Stevie Wonder singing about color.
I can't know what it's like to be Sid. I mean, he's sitting right here. I mean, I can touch him. He can touch me with the sound that he makes. I mean, he chills up my spine. I mean, it's like this is the magic of, I think, being alive and being human, is that there is this uncrossable gap.
Any more questions?
Why can you see colors when you're falling asleep, when your eyes are closed?
Why can you?
Yeah.
Well, there are couple of reasons. I don't know exactly what you're referring to, but if you just close your eyes and you push, don't do it too hard, you actually, that pressure can activate the photoreceptors and you generate what's called a phosphine. And there's a lovely account that Isaac Newton presents where he used a blunt knitting needle to actually poke the side of his eye. We're not allowed to do this anymore, you know, it's like IRB regulations and so on. But anyway, so that's one way you can do it. The other is, you know, the eyelid provides a color filter that then moderates light. And then there's a whole lot of memory effects that also kick in. And the most surprising thing to people is that when you close your eyes at night, it's not black. It goes to gray. It's like a warm gray. To see black, you actually need light. And that, I think, is yet another piece of evidence that, you know, color is part of this big package of, you know, how we experience the world is through contrast. We were talking earlier about the contrast between India and America. And color, you get an Indian, they're like monochrome.
Do we see color in dream state, like when dreaming?
This is debated. I mean, I do, and I trust me, you know. Do you?
I never recall my dreams when I wake up. So
really?
It's been a while. So wow. I don't really know.
Huh. Yeah. I'm fascinated to know about the process of like how color and sound come together for you. There's this whole world of synesthesias, right. You know, and we can go into that turf, but it is one of the oldest connections is between color and sound.
Sure. I associate certain colors with certain feelings for sure, sound, certain sonic kind of spaces, but it's been more through conversation with others who really vividly kind of correlate certain sounds or songs or whatnot with colors. I've had conversations with people after shows where they said certain songs just like inspired a deep green. Mine is definitely more of just like an abstract connect between the two, or certain tones inspiring a certain emotion that leads to a certain song happening.
You know, I wanted to know, what is the lyric about light and sound about?
The word om. So before there was light, there was a sound, which I don't know if that's scientifically true or not. But for me, om in Hinduism, again, is the first sound, the primordial sound. So that's what that's about. So before there was light, there was a sound. And that leads into the lyric about cultural appropriation. So it's kind of just like, again, me asserting that this is a core belief that I have, that the start of the universe was with om.
Mm-hmm. Okay, beautiful. Lovely. We do have to wrap up. Please help me give it up for Sid and Bevel. Sid, you're going to be doing two nights at the Music Hall of Williamsburg.
Yeah, March 8th and 9th.
March 8th and 9th.
Yeah.
Bevel, is your lab going to be doing any shows in Brooklyn?
We're not. Okay. We're not. But I am working on a book about color, which in a couple of years you'll hear about.
So how can people find out more about what you do?
The wide open world of the web.
Okay, very good.
You can email me. I mean, I respond to emails, and my email is very easy.
I called the dude.
Yeah,
he just had phone number.
I just answered the phone.
Yeah,
it's like, hi.
All right, great.
It's like this. Turns out that color isn't that hot of a. You know,
yeah. Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you to On Air and Talkhouse for having us, and once again, please give it up for our guests.
Be sure to check out Sid's album, Siddhartha, and to catch him on tour this spring. For more information, please visit his website, sidsriram.com. To learn more about Bevel's work as both painter and neuroscience researcher, you can check out his website, bevelconway.com. Sing for Science is co-produced by Talkhouse and made possible in part by a grant from the Simons Foundation. Our music is by Panoram. Social media manager is Bailey Constance, and digital producer is Keenan Cush. Special thanks to Scott Newman, Jenny Mills, Kathleen Ottinger, Paige Winston, and all of On Air Fest for helping make today's episode happen. If you like the show, the best way you can support us is to give us a review, tell a friend about our podcast, and subscribe on your platform of choice. For more information, go to singforscience.org and follow us on social media at Sing for Science. Thanks for listening.